Good morning, and welcome to Atheist Talk on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's Sunday, March 5th, 2017. I'm your host, Joseph Homridge. With me on today's program, performance artist Gaia and Jason, who also goes by the performance name of Dionysus Jones, and Hertzie, member of the Unholy Ghostbusters. And today they'll be talking about toxic masculinity. The phone lines are open. You can join the conversation by calling us at 952-926-6205.
946-6205, sorry.
So sorry. What was the correction, please?
946-6205.
You were one number off. 946-6205. Thank you. Thank you for the correction. Gaia, Jason, and Hertzie, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Can we get started? Gaia, could you start us off by defining toxic masculinity?
I like starting with easy questions. Toxic masculinity, at least as I think we're talking about it today, is how gender roles and expectations are affecting, specifically in this case, men, but and how those spill out onto women and men and children in our society. When we talk about it as a toxic thing, we're talking about the things that are forcing men into roles that are not healthy for society or for themselves or for the people in their lives.
And could you talk about what kind of characteristics that this includes?
A lot of it's around the idea of hypermasculinity, the like you have to be strong, you have to like strong both physically and not showing emotion, and you know, be the breadwinner and all of the things that we stereotype men as being. And if you don't live up to those, you're somehow lesser or a problem.
All right, and Adam. Curiosity of like what kind of characters would you say in literature, and I know you both are geeks, but so some of our geeky literature and non-geeky literature kind of show what toxic masculinity is.
One of the easy ones would be Gaston from Beauty and the Beast.
Oh my gosh, yes.
super masculine. I'm strong, I can hunt things, I can do everything, but also in his relationship, like, I want Belle, therefore I should get Belle. And she is not really interested, and he doesn't care.
That's the soft hitting one. I'm about to piss off a lot of geeks. Ready? Here we go.
Go for it.
Let's talk about Firefly for a second.
Ooh.
So Jane is an obvious example of toxic masculinity, right? Here's this big guy. The closest thing he has to emotion is, you know, maybe getting a little heroic once in a while. But he
gets happy with the hat.
He gets real sappy about a hat.
And the gun when he was going to give the
gun
to Mal.
Okay, so he has two emotions, one of which is based around killing things. Another one is based around his mother.
Exactly.
So those are safe ways for men to show emotion. Jane is pretty much classic, here's this manly man and look how manly he is. Mal is also a great example of toxic masculinity. Now I just pissed off all the geeks. So if you look at Mal's issues throughout Firefly, all of his issues come down to his inability to have a conversation about his own emotions honestly. He can't get together with Inara because he can't say he likes her. Overriding theme in the show.
Yes.
He can't connect with the doctor because he can't say that he cares for Kaylee. Overriding theme in the show.
Yep.
And then by contrast, we have, like, Wash, who's considered this very weak character, right? Not as in his characterization is weak. His characterization is excellent.
Amazing.
But he as a person is weak because he loves Zoe, because he's willing to talk about his emotion. He gets in a fight with Zoe about how he wants to be more manly. Like, his masculinity is very much called into question constantly, and it's constantly called into question because he has emotions, because he's not this big burly man, because he doesn't know how to shoot a gun. Like, and the doctor to some extent as well.
The doctor even more so gets you know, ragged on for being weak, for being, you know, prissy, for being all of these things.
The doctor being Simon Tam.
Yes, doctor being Simon Tam. We're talking Firefly here. Not.
I know. Just in case the geeky crowd was getting confused with Doctor Who.
That's an interesting.
Depending on which version of the Doctor, yeah. There are some elements that come in at various times.
So let's not fall down that rabbit hole.
And I so wanted to fall down that rabbit hole. So let's see. And then what areas of life do we see, like, toxic masculinity kind of in action? Obviously, TV and media is one.
All of them.
Yeah, I would say all of them. You know, like, I work in IT and, you know, it's a slightly different form of masculinity among, you know, male IT workers, which the male is almost redundant, unfortunately. But it's still very much a guys are there and women get talked over and, you know, that these same issues appear everywhere.
So can I bring up a specific example that happened at your work that you came home and talked to me about?
Yep.
There was you guys were having a meeting and talking about one set of clients, and one of the clients is known to be a little bit more finicky to work with, and they started talking about this woman's appearance and how if you talk about her appearance, then she becomes easier to work with, as if the men in the room had to somehow manage the emotions of this woman. And yet they have another client who is even more difficult to work with, who nobody talks about him as needing to be managed. Mm-hmm. This is a byproduct of toxic masculinity, this idea that women are emotional and men aren't, and therefore we have to manage women's emotions and we don't have to manage men's. And yet the reality is that every human has emotions. That's part of being human. And so when you reduce men's emotions to happy, sad, and angry, and maybe sad is sort of optional, like you don't allow men to have the full range of emotions, and in the process you shove those emotions off on women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely see that. So I brought up this radio show specifically in a Facebook group I'm in, A Civilized Heresy, if you're listening, Vincent. And One of the comments asked if there was a toxic femininity.
I'll start this. I mean, in some senses, yes, because, you know, and we've been talking about this for a long time of unrealistic beauty standards, of, you know, especially these days where women are expected to work and keep the house and raise the children and do everything. You could call that toxic femininity, you know, setting up these feminine gender role expectations and asking women to live up to them in a way that's detrimental to themselves. But I would argue that there's a power dynamic in play that is the reason toxic masculinity is a thing and toxic femininity is not, because women or men hold the power in this society.
Thank you. Do you think that as artists, or you may have a particular sensitivity to these things? I think perhaps a lot of us just go through our days without really thinking about these roles. Could you maybe discuss what it is that has allowed you to be more sensitive or more perceptive to such things and how you got interested? And
my real awareness of these things really started. We were in the Peace Corps in the South Pacific, and the gender divide there is
the size of the Grand Canyon.
Massive. So, you know, kind of the gender roles and the way they impact interactions was just unavoidable there. And then when we came back, I was, you know, kind of – there was – kind of an expectation of coming back and we're more progressive here and whatnot. But like having seen it so starkly there, I came back and I'm like, oh, crap, we have far more of these problems here than I realized. So that kind of started it. But then as I started performing burlesque and kind of questioning my own expression of gender, my burlesque, one of my pieces is to Let It Go from Frozen. And I, you know, put on sparkly makeup and dance around and that kind of thing. And that's very much not a thing that's exactly masculine. But, like, I also don't fit into the box of the boylesque, flamboyant, gay kind of stuff that's common in male burlesque. So, like, where am I in terms of the gender roles?
Gaia, what's your experience been?
So I've been an artist basically my entire life, and to ask me to detach my art from who I am is to ask me to detach my name from my ID. Like, I can't. Having said that, I also don't present very feminine. We are on radio, so as a note, Jason is wearing bright blue lipstick and blue eyeshadow, and I'm wearing none lipstick and none eyeshadow. And I'm also wearing, like, men's pants and a men's shirt because I'm going to go to work and I work backstage. This is also my day-to-day presentation. I don't present really deeply feminine. I don't wear makeup. I don't spend a lot of time on my hair. And that has presented for me a problem fairly regularly, as in people look at me and they go, well, you aren't that feminine. And I think that this is – it ties back in with the toxic masculinity side of this because I am not presenting my own gender. I am not presenting a traditionally female gender role, and that ends up coming out in my art and for me, in representation in my art. I get really excited when I see other artists represent women who are not traditionally female but who are still female. Women who aren't feminine, who aren't these glittery, sparkly creatures, but who are yet still deeply female.
Hmm. Interesting. Thank you very much. We are going to take a break in a few minutes, for a few minutes right now, and we will be coming back and talking again about the topic of toxic masculinity. Good morning and welcome back to Atheist Talk on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Today, Gaia, Jason, and Hertzie are in the studio talking about toxic masculinity. At this point, Hertzie, could you give us some announcements?
Yes, we actually just have two announcements today. The first one is today we do have a Cucumbers Brunch meetup after the show. Please join us. I know at least I'll be there, and we may have one or two of our guests. We'll see. But join us there for talking about the show and just having some good, delicious food. Also, don't forget that you do get a discount with the Atheist newsletter. And then secondly, we have our Donors of the Week, which is Jim and Jim. Yes, that is two different gyms. But thank you very much, Jim, and to all our donors who helped make the show go.
Thank you. And I believe you had some further topics you wish to continue with, Hertzie?
Oh, I certainly hope so, because we got to fill this up. No, I'm kidding. We probably could fill this up, especially if we go down some of the geeky rabbit holes. But I know during the break we talked about where we wanted to go, and we wanted to talk about male awareness and communication about feelings. So where do you guys want to start with that?
So I think for men, learning to communicate about feelings is really difficult. There's somebody on the internet is going to have to correct me and find all of the studies for me. But there's a really interesting sociological study that came out maybe 5 years ago where they had men list all of the words they could think of for emotion, and they had women list all the words they could think of for emotion. And the women's list was something like 4 times longer than the men's list. We provide tools, we as a society provide tools to women to have emotions. We provide nuance to our emotions. I can be anxious, but I can also be irritated, and I can also be frustrated, and I can also worry. We don't provide that same even linguistic vocabulary to men. So when men are trying to learn, trying to unlearn this, they have this barrier to deal with. There's also like coping mechanisms that, you know, I learned when I was like 6 about how to deal with my own emotions, that as Jason is going through this process of learning to deal with his emotions, I'm realizing he doesn't have. And it's stuff that I learned growing up. I don't know when I picked up the skill that was, okay, I am unhappy right now. What do I need to do to fix it? And sometimes what I need to do to fix it is to walk away from the situation. And I can recognize when it's walk away, when it's dig in with it, when it's maybe change the subject for a little while. I can recognize that in me, but I realize that that's not a coping mechanism that Jason got to learn growing up.
You know, a lot of times the kind of line for this with kids is boys will be boys. You know, boys get upset and smash the blocks that somebody else was building or, you know, hit another kid or whatever. And we kind of just say, oh, boys will be boys. They'll do this thing. And that kind of that means that we don't – that boys never have responsibility for their own emotions, for dealing with them in a healthy way or any of that.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
So the big concept that I want to just throw out here, and there's a great thread on Metafilter if you want to look this up online, emotional labor.
Yes.
it's a thing. Like, emotional labor is just the taking responsibility for emotions yourselves and others. And it's not necessarily a bad thing because, you know, like in our friendships, in our relationships, in all of this, we help support each other. But in our society, because men don't know how to deal with their own emotions and often aren't – part of that is aren't even quite aware of the range of emotions you're experiencing. We only, like I brought up, we only have a limited vocabulary to talk about them. So when you're feeling some nuanced emotion, it comes out as usually anger or something like that. And often the women in our lives are expected to help us deal with this. You know, there's the line of, I wish somebody would just, you know, go have sex with him so he can calm down.
Mm.
That's expecting a woman to do stuff. You know, same with the housework. You know, kind of in order to do things around the house, things around the house that are not like housework, you know, to just chill out, the house has to be taken care of. And we expect women to do that. That actually does tie into emotional labor.
All right. And then, actually, it's interesting you talk about the boys will be boys because I have a nephew who is about 2 years old right now. And admittedly, that is one thing I'm looking at and going, okay, there are some phrases I need to look at. Like, what kind of phrases do you guys see aside from the boys will be boys that we, you know, need to look at constructively or critically?
The idea and the phrase of, oh, he just likes you. So when a boy comes to a young girl and pulls her hair, oh, he's just flirting. He just likes you. No, he's being a jerk. Like, and he's not able to handle his emotions. He's dumping this emotion of wanting something from her onto her.
Yep, because now she has to actually, you know, respond, but she has to respond positively.
Right.
Yeah.
There's an Adele song that if you take the whole song in context – this is not as much about toxic masculinity, but the chorus is, if you're going to let me down gently. Don't pretend that you don't want me. And I think that summarizes a lot of this problem of, like, we expect that because men have not been taught how to deal with their own emotions, we expect that women are going to reject them, but reject them gently in a way that makes them – make sure that they still feel like a man. And I'm like, rejection hurts.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how it's done, rejection hurts. And if a woman does it wrong, she's putting herself at risk. She's putting her safety at risk. And then we get trapped in this, well, why didn't you just say no? Because it's not safe for me to say no. Well, why is it not safe for me to say no? Because men haven't been taught how to handle the emotions of rejection, and that sucks.
And how does that work with, like, males and their friend, you know, other male friends then? Because, for example, I know one of the topics that we talked about was platonic male touch.
I mean, everybody needs some amount of touch, and it varies. Different people need different amounts of touch, but women get more touch. Men kind of classically see touch as – or stereotypically – touch is kind of sexual, so we don't touch each other. And if we're touching a woman, it's, you know,
inherently
sexual. So kind of separating the idea of sexuality and touch is a thing we need to do because as men, we need to touch each other just like, you know, leaning on your friend's shoulder or whatever. But also being able to interact with female friends and not have it be inherently sexual.
Yeah, I think that what Jason is getting at here is this idea that women are allowed to touch each other. Like, I can walk up to another woman and give them a hug, and that's considered totally normal. But Jason can't walk up to another guy and have it be – and give them a hug and have that be considered normal. That's abnormal. That's, oh, God, you might be gay. which we won't even.
Yeah.
But this idea that I have the ability to get a hug, to get contact, to hold somebody's hand, to rest my head on someone's shoulder whenever I want, but men can't, because for men, touch has to be intentionally sexual. When really we're pack creatures, we need to touch each other. We need humanity.
All right. Well, it looks like we have another break coming up, but we'll be right back.
We'll be back after a message from our sponsors. Good morning, and welcome back to Atheist Talk on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. I'm your host, Joseph Homrich. Today, performance artist Gaia and Jason are joining Hertzy and myself in the studio talking about toxic masculinity. Gaia and Jason, as I've been listening to you, one of the things that comes up to me as a scientist is I know more than the average amount about human evolution and how we've all evolved as men and women, and men and women, of course, have different ways of behaving that tend to promote their more successful reproduction. So there's not only nurture, of course, there's nature. There is definite differences, I think, between men and women that have evolved over the years and are probably common to just about all societies. I'm wondering if you think there's been a shift over the years, the centuries, the millennia, because of our particular cultures. Would one of you like to address that?
I think there definitely has been shifting in especially around gender roles and what it is to be masculine or feminine. I mean, like, heels were originally masculine, ruffles were originally masculine, makeup was originally masculine, and yet, like, today, me wearing makeup is weird, you know. Like, because I do a lot of performance, I need to put on makeup, but I haven't done it my whole life, so I've been uncomfortable with it. So, like, I started making myself put on makeup to go to work because just to practice it. And the first time I did it, it was like this big nerve-wracking thing because I was like, I'm doing something weird, and yet nobody noticed. Hertz gave me a funny look because I work with her, and I don't think she knew that.
It was just done so well. I was like, dang it, I can't do it that well.
No, I can't either.
Yeah. It's like I'm actually similar to you, at least in the makeup department. I almost never wear makeup. And when I do, it's like, okay, is this too high? Is this too high? I went too high. Where's the hydrogen peroxide?
Yeah. To bring it back to the historical for a second, the way that we interact with people of our own sex has definitely changed. If you look at the literature from Edwardian, Victorian England, there was this really sharp gender divide, right? Like, men stayed with men, women stayed with women, never the twain shall meet except to try to reproduce. And in that, you can see these platonic relationships between men that are much deeper and more emotional and even in the imagery, there's much more touching and physical contact, which are part of what we were just talking about before the break, of how we don't have that now. So there is definitely shifts that are happening, and I'm curious to see where this third wave of feminism that's bringing up these issues of toxic masculinity and dragging them, kicking and screaming, into the 21st century. I'm really curious to see where this brings us and how this is going to influence the next 50 years and our next generation.
And it's also interesting that you bring up the point with the Edwardian and the Victorian relationships. It makes me think of the new Sherlock Holmes that's been coming out with Benedict Cumberbatch. There's a lot of people who are shipping Watson and Holmes, which on one hand I'm like, great, that, you know, it's a good ship. But then I also look and I'm like, why can't they just be friends? You know,
it's because they're touching.
But they're friend. Watson's always been a massive admirer of Holmes, and it's always been kind of, you know, for us now, we look at it in the sexual way because almost everything is sexualized. But it's also like, can't they just be really good friends who admire each other and love each other as friends?
And I think it's interesting that we're even, like, can't even just let men be friends, much less, you know, like with the new Star Wars movies. I hope that Rey and Finn don't have any romantic plot. Can we just have them be friends? That would be great.
I would like all three of them to just be friends. That's yeah. my big goal right there. It's like, let's just have them be friends and go and be there for each other as they need to be there for each other.
As I'm hearing you talk, I'm wondering if perhaps the changing and the shifting of male roles may be due to greater male isolation. Perhaps the support systems and the closer friendships that in other societies and contexts and years that they had have been diminishing and disappearing, and now we are expecting women to take up that support.
Absolutely.
Chicken and the egg.
Yep. I think it's a cycle that feeds on itself. I know, you know, one of the things that since I've been back from the Peace Corps and more aware of these things, I've been kind of trying to figure out how to have closer, deeper friendships. I would like to have them with men. It hasn't – like I haven't managed to make those connections with men. So my close friendships are all with women.
I also – to use the example of the Peace Corps where we were serving in Vanuatu, we spent our first 2 years in a village of 100 people. So in a village of 100 people, everybody is kin. Everybody is a blood relation of maybe two removes, maybe. But really, like, these are tight kin relationships. And the men there had so many brothers, right? They had brothers and they had cousin brothers and – it was this complicated web, but there was always, for the men, there was always a sense of camaraderie with the other brothers. There was nobody left out. There was nobody excluded from that because you grew up with them. And there was also none of this trying to sexualize it because this is your brother, this is your sister, this is your auntie, this is your nephew. Like, these are not people who you can sexualize. And I think that in many ways that was a lot healthier, as much as there was issues in that society as there is anywhere, but I think that for men, there was a much stronger support network among the men that included physical touch. It included hugs. It included backslaps. It included doing each other favors. It included helping each other out in a way that I haven't really seen since I've come home.
Awesome. If you guys don't mind, I actually do want to come back. Well, it kind of ties into this whole friends thing. There's been this thing that's gone around the internet a couple of times, I know, called the friend zone.
The girlfriend zone?
Also that, too. You did bring up those words.
Well, just to define it, the friend zone is the idea that a boy is interested in a girl. Boy probably doesn't express this interest and, you know, they're friends for a while, and eventually he gets around to saying that he's interested in her, and she's like, we should just be friends. That concept is, like, complete and utter bullshit. It's what it is the girlfriend zone. The boy has put the girl in the girlfriend zone, and despite saying that he's her friend and, you know, kind of fulfilling that role, he's actually putting tokens into the machine and hoping to get sex out of it. So it's really generally the guy has said, you're going to be my girlfriend. And
no, the guy hasn't said, you're going to be my girlfriend, and that's the problem.
Yeah.
To express this a little bit more deeply, I think that there's this issue around, again, this comes back to the lack of emotional expression, that men aren't allowed to say, I like you and I'm interested. They are allowed to, as children, you know, pull hair and steal bags and be jerks, and we say boys will be boys. And then they realize that that's not working for them once they get out of junior high, and so they start being nice, and they form what is honestly a genuine friendship, but it's a genuine friendship based on this idea that they think that this woman is going to fall in love and want to have sex with them.
And this does get like reinforced in popular media. You know, look at a lot of romantic comedies. You have these kind of setups that happen all the time. Look at video games where, you know, you go on the quest and your reward is the girl.
Even a lot of science fiction fantasy media has this idea, this here is this woman. She's great. She's independent. She's amazing. Here is this guy. He has some growing up to do because he's the protagonist, and we can't start a protagonist, you know, protagonist start at level one. And he goes on this adventure, and he becomes this amazing person, and now she falls in love with him. Like, no, maybe she doesn't. Maybe she thinks he's a really great guy, and they become best friends.
It's my turn to piss off the nerds. I really saw that with the Guardians of the Galaxy movie and the trailers. And I love the movie, but it's just one of those things where I'm like, oh, come on. Can't we just avoid this whole thing right here? Gamora and Peter can just be friends and not make this into a thing.
And to be honest, like, stories like this are in and of themselves not necessarily a bad thing. It's the fact that all of them are this way.
That is also true.
Except Moana. And everybody should go see Moana because it's delightful.
Oh my gosh. I got to see it Thanksgiving weekend, and I fully admit teared up at least twice, and the whole thing was just amazing.
I'm going to go see it for the fourth time today.
I am jealous.
I have a 17-year-old daughter, and we both bonded over this movie. And she was the first person to recognize the fact, for those of you who haven't seen the movie, I don't think I'm giving too much away, that there is a wonderful friendship that develops in this movie between an adolescent girl and an adult man, and it is completely on the level of friendship. This is not the typical Disney princess movie where, you know, just about every other movie with Disney and a young adolescent girl, the objective is to find a man.
Yes, there is no romantic through line, and it's delightful.
And it's delightful. It's a wonderful movie.
Yeah, I think after I watched it, I was like, you know, it's more like, you know, the girl and her crazy uncle.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good call.
I really liked that because I was like, you know, everybody has a slightly crazy uncle, and we should, you know, celebrate those guys.
You know, if men are in fact feeling the anxiety of this, and they're maybe will reach one day a nice big threshold. I don't know. Do you guys feel that there is becoming some sort of recognition of this? And are things getting better, getting worse? Is anyone even talking about it?
I mean, obviously we're talking about it here. I seek out articles about this and share it online. There is a growing awareness of this as a thing. I think oftentimes it is a lot of the articles and think pieces and whatever that I see are talking about are a woman talking about how this is a problem, which is a place to start because we need to be aware that it is a problem. But I think the next steps are going to be guys talking about how this is a problem for us because it's so often framed in the women are expected to do the emotional labor, you know, guys can't take no and women are in danger. And that's important to talk about and acknowledge, but I want to see more about how it's hurting men and what we can do and, you know, guys talking to each other about it.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys have seen this, but sometimes I feel like whenever something comes up, it's like, okay, so now we see this problem. Then guys turn to the ladies and go, so how are you going to fix it? And mm-hmm. It's like, you know, technically I haven't created this problem. Why do I have to fix it?
Or even if guys are aware that we should be fixing it, it's turn to the woman and say, how do I fix it? Which mm-hmm. is just still making
yeah.
good work.
Yeah.
Are any of you surprised that in this age of mass communication and instant information that this isn't being talked about more?
No. Sorry, was that really cynical? No,
it's really fast.
Why would it be talked about more? It's scary and hard. Mm-hmm. It's asking men to do something that men have not traditionally done, and even in this world of mass communication, the gatekeepers are still men. So we're asking men to step up and do hard work, and that's hard and scary. Why would we talk about that?
Some sobering thoughts. Well, thank you very much. On today's program, Jason and Gaia and my friend Hertzie and I have been talking about the subject of toxic masculinity. Thank you to all of our listeners, and we will hear from you next week.
Hello and welcome to the American Atheist Viewpoint. I'm Nick Fish, National Program Director for American Atheists, and I'm joining you this week from CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C. This year, American Atheists once again attended CPAC, tabling, bringing the message to the conservative political activists here at CPAC that they need to try to divorce movement conservatism from the agenda of the religious right, that those sorts of things are bad politics, that they're turning away millions of voters, and that they're bad for the political discourse we have in this country. Overall, the message tends to be very well received. A lot of the young folks who are here in particular fall into that demographic of 40% of people under 30 who are non-religious. One of the things that people think that we're here for, or that we're trying to do, that needs to be dispelled, and this is something that comes from within our own community and needs to be clearly articulated: we're not here at CPAC to bring conservatives into the atheist movement, to recruit people who oppose many of the things that all of us take for granted politically. So I'm talking about LGBT equality, I'm talking about women's issues, I'm talking about abortion access, I'm talking about religious freedom, the real definition of religious freedom. We disagree. We disagree very strongly about that. But the reason that we're here, and I've talked about this before, and I think it bears repeating, because every time we come here, people misinterpret why we're here or misunderstand what it is that we're trying to do. We're trying to make it so that the Republican Party and conservative politics no longer goes hand in hand with theocratic use of our government to impose religion on the rest of us. If we can do that, we can actually have policy debates about the things that are important and that are, that deal with, housing policy, or deal with, the size of our military, or whatever other issue, or tax policy. Those are actually important political discussions that we should be having. The fact that we have to sit here and discuss whether or not it's appropriate for a United States senator to say that if you don't get out of bed every morning and drop to your knees in prayer, you're not qualified to be president. Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz said that. A sitting United States senator, when he was running for president, said that. And if we have to spend time rebutting stuff like that, we're not actually talking about the issues that should matter, the issues that actually are important. We're wasting our time talking about these things that ought not be partisan. There shouldn't be a left or right to separation of religion from government. These should not be controversial things. And that's what we're trying to bring to this crowd, and why it's important for us to be here, and why it's important for us to talk to people who we disagree with. When somebody like Marco Rubio says, if you don't believe in a higher power, you can't understand what it means to be an American, that's dumb politics, but it's also telling 40% of young people that a leader of one of the two major political parties, that they don't want your vote. And so those people who may have good political ideas and may, have other ideas we disagree with, they're disengaging. And it bears out when you look at the number of non-religious folks who are actually turning out to the polls, the number who are actually involved in politics. The number is lower than we would expect. Part of that is because one of the political parties in particular has made it part of their mode of conducting politics to disparage non-believers and to tie their political identity to religion, and to tie patriotism to religion, tie everything to religion. Let's be clear, though, the Democratic Party isn't blameless in all of this. The Democratic Party had operatives at the DNC suggest using Senator Sanders' perceived atheism, not even his actual atheism. He doesn't say that he is an atheist. Using the perception that he wasn't religious enough, using that against him in the primary. So this is something that happens on both sides, but obviously we don't want to pretend that it's equally bad on both sides. All that having been said, there are people who are going to oppose us even being here, oppose us, legitimizing something that they see as overly extreme. My response to that is, if the President of the United States and the Vice President of the United States and multiple members of the Senate are coming to this thing, it is mainstream, sort of by definition. This is where political discussion is happening. The people who are here, if you look at the straw poll, if you look at the demographics of the folks who show up to this thing, it's young people. more than half the people who are here are under 30. And since that's the case, it's important for us to engage with these people because they are on our side on church-state separation issues. These are the sorts of things that, you know, as a person who works for American Atheists, I would be thrilled to put ourselves out of business because everybody politically agreed that using government to prop up one religion or the other, using government to give special treatment to religions, or using your religion as the basis for governing. If we could get agreement that that stuff was a bad idea, I would be happy to pack it up and call it a day and move on to arguing about other things that I care about in the political realm. But we're not there. So what we need to do is try to reduce the damage that's done by shoring up or by the shoring up of the religious conservatives within the Republican Party. The share of evangelicals within the Republican vote this year was higher than it had ever been. Something like more than 80% of evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. That base is solidifying around him and voting like they're a small religious minority group. That's not a winning political strategy in the long term, but it certainly was just enough to get them across the finish line this time. But we need to get their influence out of politics, and the sooner that happens, the better. If anyone has, you know, concerns, critiques, criticisms of us being at CPAC, I would love to hear them. But I say this as a person who spent my career working, the first part of my career working in progressive politics and working on the Democratic side of things. This is important. And if I can talk to the folks here about making the party and making the conservative movement less bad, it's something I'm going to do and I'm going to continue to do. All that having been said, there was a media, you know, circus around Milo and him getting kicked out good, and the folks who, you know, Richard Spencer, the guy who is, some have said that he's just basically legitimately a Nazi, him getting kicked out of CPAC as well, you know, that was this big story that came out of this. But the story that you're probably not going to hear so much about are the conversations that you can that we've been able to have with people and changing their minds and encouraging them to be outspoken about separation of religion and government in conservative spaces. I want to leave with a quote from an article that I wrote, I guess it's been 2 years ago now, about why this is important. Here's what I said. I'd much rather fight against bad economic positions when they aren't based in religion. And I'd rather fight about those positions than the ridiculous notions that come out of culture war conservatism. When you have God on your side, there can be no argument. That's just how it is. And if you don't like it, too bad, heathen. That's what we need to get away from. I think it's important for us to argue politics loudly. But if you're up against God, there's not a whole lot of space to go. That's all I have the time for today. Thank you so much for joining us for the American Atheist Viewpoint. For more information about what we're working on, please visit www.atheists.org. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you next week.